Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
Providing insight and resources for your spiritual journey. Unity Online Radio.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with Paul John Roach, Minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here's your host, Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. It's a beautiful late January day here. We're very fortunate that we're not involved in all that huge snowstorm that's happening on the East Coast. In fact, it's quite balmy. I think we're in the 70s here. For me, today's show is pure gold. The reason for that is we're talking about my favorite mystic, the great Meister Eckhart, and perhaps Eckhart's greatest modern champion is with me, the legendary scholar and activist Matthew Fox. Dr. Fox's latest book is entitled Meister Eckhart, A Mystic Warrior for Our Times. And it brings with passion and intellectual solidity, and that's a nice balance, isn't it? We've got passion and intellectual solidity, the deeply relevant message of Meister Eckhart. And it brings it into compelling focus through having him interact with a whole variety of modern teachers and mystics on topics ranging from awe and celebration to emptying and the divine dark, from depth psychology and deep ecology to education and ecumenism. On the journey, we see the inter-spirituality of Meister Eckhart, and I think that's a key idea, and his brothers and sisters in Hinduism, Sufism, Shamanism, Buddhism, and movements that seek to instill a unitive interconnectedness and celebration of love in place of the old numbing dualisms and judgments of dogma. And it seems to me that in our spiritual quest in modern day America, perhaps throughout the world right now, we're dealing with this. Do we go back into the old dualisms, which really are based on judgment, or do we burst through into this new unitive understanding where we celebrate love as the paramount force in the universe? Of course, in unity, we know which side we stand, and proud to do so. And we know that Matthew Fox also is in that camp. And this book is a wonderful call to action, as many of his books are. So it's a real pleasure and joy to welcome Matt Fox back to the show. So welcome. Thank you, Dr. Fox.
Thank you, Paul John, for having me. And I'm delighted to hear that Eckhart is your favorite mystic. So I guess we have a lot in common.
Absolutely. You know, I don't know what it is about him, but you know, some people you read, don't you, and it all falls into place. You know, you feel, yeah, I could have said that. That resonates deeply within my own being. And then you read somebody else, and you know it's wonderful stuff, but it just doesn't resonate. I've tried and tried to read Sri Aurobindo, for instance, and I know he's a wonderful intellectual genius and a spiritual giant, but it doesn't connect with me. But when I read Meister Eckhart, yeah, there I am. You know, I feel him in my bones, and I think that's what brings it alive. You know, this book it covers a lot of ground, doesn't it? And yet it's also a little bit like a mandala, a sort of a spiral, illuminating recurring topics and themes. You know, we talked about the interfaith into spirituality idea, but we also keep hearing about the eternal now and birthing compassion, panentheism, and above all else, I think, direct experience. And to me, this is the key, isn't it, to understanding Meister Eckhart, his invitation. I guess it's the key to any mystic, is inviting us into a direct experience.
Exactly. That, to me, is how we can come closest to defining our mysticism, is that it is our direct experience. I like to quote the psalmist, "Taste and see that God is good." So we have to do the tasting. It's not a vicarious activity. And also, if you're going to renew religion, we have to get back to the direct experience, to the spiritual dimension. It's not enough to reshuffle chairs on the deck. We have to get to the essence, and that has to do with experience. And that's really what I think mysticism is about. And Eckhart is the champion, clearly, when it comes to the experiential. At the same time, there's nothing anti-intellectual about him, or anti-activist, because he was those things as well. Mm-hmm. But he so names and dares to name the experiential. And as you say, even you, we living in America, what, 8 centuries after Eckhart, six centuries, can appreciate what he's saying, that it speaks to us still at the level of our hearts and the level of our own experience. So his genius is special. And I think one thing I learned doing this book is how many non-Christians have appreciated Eckhart. I quote Dr. Suzuki, the Japanese Buddhist, about how Eckhart is the one Zen thinker of the West, he said. And then Kumar Swami, the Hindu thinker, he says that reading Eckhart is like reading the Upanishads.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the greatest compliment any Hindu could give anybody.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And he says the whole sentences in Eckhart that read like they were translated from the Sanskrit. And so Eckhart is uncanny, I think, for his breadth and his depth. And he never met a Buddhist in his life. He never met a Hindu in his life. But he plunges to such a depth to his own journey as a Christian that he ends up in the same common waters as does the wisdom of the Buddhists and the wisdom of the Hindus. And I think this is really what the Unity Church is about. And your program that began saying unity within all faith traditions is what you're seeking. Well, I think Eckhart is a champion of that, perhaps like none other.
Yes. You know, we tend to think of the Renaissance, don't we, as the beginning of the modern era, you know, the modern mind, the way of thinking. And before that, you know, we got the medieval period, etc. But Meister Eckhart, it seems to be astonishingly modern, doesn't he, in the sense that we don't feel there's a veil between him and us. His perceptions are so almost Jungian. You know, there's a sort of a psychological savvy to his understanding that seems like, well, this couldn't have been written, you know, 600 years ago. It sounds too modern, even postmodern or something. How is that? What is it about this guy?
Well, you brought in Jung, and of course I have a whole chapter on Jung and Eckhart, because Jung says Eckhart gave him the key to the unconscious. Now that's
yes.
Huge compliment, and Jung quotes Eckhart over 38 times in his works, and has a whole essay on Eckhart. So clearly, Jung derived a great deal from Eckhart. And I just think that Eckhart goes so deeply into the human psyche, and that he, but so too does Buddhism. I mean, when you think about it, most successful religions have tapped into archetypes, universal truths that we all carry as human beings, and I would say that Eckhart is postmodern precisely because he's pre-modern. I think a lot of the modern enterprise was frankly about wiping out the pre-moderns. I mean, when the destruction of and the genocide done indigenous wisdom and peoples and their cultures was part of that effort. Whereas today I think we've learned a little bit of humility from our mistakes in the modern era, and that part of postmodernism is to welcome the wisdom of the pre-modern. And that's why I love not only Eckhart, but Hildegard of Bingen and Thomas Aquinas. These pre-modern thinkers have more in common with the postmodern time than they do with the modern time. Eckhart was ignored in the modern time for in religion. Some philosophers picked up on him for sure, but in these postmodern times, I think he's really made to order for our times. Again, I have a chapter, as you mentioned, on shamanism, and of course, what Eckhart has in common with shamanism and with a pre-modern spiritual practice is very profound also. So it's one more reason why he's really relevant to our time, because the modern age, as we know, was, what should I say, it was quite anti-mystical. For example, the Theodore Rosak once wrote that the Enlightenment, which of course is the birth of the modern philosophy, he says the Enlightenment held mysticism up for ridicule as the worst offense against science and reason. And that's why a lot of Protestant churches are quite illiterate about the mystical tradition, because they grew up in the modern period, which was essentially anti-mystical. And again, there's a hunger today for the mysticism. I think that's a hunger that the Unity Church and some of the other metaphysical traditions are helping to fill. But really, this is a very pre-modern movement. Some people say, oh, mysticism is something new age. No, it's ancient. It's something very ancient. And exactly. It's certainly present in the scriptures and the whole cosmic Christ tradition that comes from the earliest writings in the Christian Bible, from Paul's writings. They don't come from New Age writings, but they have something in common insofar as the mystical is taken seriously.
Right. And in a sense, you know, as a result of the Enlightenment, mysticism almost got shunted into the sentimental. You know, there were great mystical writers like Wordsworth and Coleridge, for instance, but you know, they were talking about nature, and so it was okay to see nature as in a mystical sense. But meanwhile, we have, you know, the rationalism of industrialization, etc. And I think it was only we had to wait till Emerson and Thoreau really to combine that sense of, you know, God in nature with a larger understanding, and thank God, you know, that the transcendentalists did come along, because I think they influenced the American way of approaching mysticism, and certainly led to unity, because I think you know, part of the origin of the Unity Church comes out of transcendentalism. You know, you have this book starts off with a bang, folks. It's got an amazing first chapter on one of my favorite themes, which is awe and wonder, because I think that's the only proper way to approach God, is just with that just wide-eyed appreciation for the amazing and sometimes terrifying aspects of the universe and what God is. But I like what you do in the first chapter. You sort of tie in Eckhart's understanding of awe and wonder, and its correlation to justice, yes, because once we have right relation, once we have our priorities in good order, it seems that we can then work for a deeper sense of justice, yes?
Absolutely, and I, of course, the first chapter is dedicated mostly to Rabbi Heschel, who mm-hmm. is a marvelous spokesperson for the Jewish tradition around this subject of awe. His favorite phrase was radical amazement. He says, we're here to be radically amazed. And he says, what we lack is not a will to believe, but a will to wonder, to stand still and behold. And he talks a lot about the beauty and grandeur of the universe. But as is typical of the healthy Jewish tradition, this does steer into behavior. And of course, that behavior is about justice. Look at it this way. You know, what's uglier than injustice? I mean, the killing of this young black man in Ferguson, you know, for no good reason at all, it's ugly, and as well as unjust. And
yes.
Our efforts at justice, our efforts at making awe more available to everybody, and not stifling it or siphoning it just through the hands of the haves, and preventing the have-nots from experiencing the beauty of life. So there is a real connection between the quest for beauty and the quest for justice. And I think this is one of the biggest contributions that the Western tradition makes, and it is the Jewish prophetic tradition from which Jesus also derives, that insists on a connection between justice and the goodness of life and the love of life. And I was glad to hear you talk about unity and the origins and the transcendentalists, because it's so true that the American spiritual genius, I think, is earth-based. And you have it in Emerson and Thoreau, but you also have it in Walt Whitman, of course, and John Muir, and these great souls in America who, who experienced the spiritual, the nature mysticism and the spiritual amazement and awe of being close to nature, and also the healing powers of being close to nature. So I think this is one reason the creation spiritual tradition, which has been my vocation to help articulate for over 40 years, I think this is one reason it kind of came alive in America again, because in many ways it had been squelched by the Enlightenment, by the rationalism, and the anthropocentrism, the human-centeredness of the modern era. And again, yes, this is why I think the pre-moderns, including indigenous people, but also people like Meister Eckhart and Hildegard of Bingen, these have so much to say to us today.
Well, and we were talking about that on a previous show, I think in last week's show, you know, the idea that there's these two threads in American society, isn't there? There's the thread of rationalism and progress and industrialism, and then there's this noble thread of awe for nature and the establishment of our amazing system of national parks and things like that. And this noble tradition, I think, is, sometimes squelched by those who just want to use everything as a resource. But I think more and more people are understanding how precious that is. I've got to applaud our president right now, because I think he's created more or set aside more parks than many other presidents in his tenure, and it just increased the size of one in Alaska, I believe. And this is so important, I think, that we have spaces set aside. It's also important, and I'm a big advocate for this, that we honor the nature in our own backyards in our cities and create spaces, so we don't have to go all the way to Yosemite or Yellowstone to appreciate wild nature, that nature can be right with us in our inner cities, in our local environment. I think that's crucially important too.
Absolutely important. And also our very bodies. Our bodies are nature, and they depend on nature, and the whole question of good food is important, and who's making the decisions about plant life and the seeds in our culture and what we're going to preserve for future generations. And, of course, the health of the waters and the forest and the soil and the air, all that, these are spiritual issues, because they are about honoring and celebrating the accomplishments of nature, and that certainly includes the human body. And obviously we want healthy bodies for our children to go with healthy minds and healthy spirits.
Yeah, I was just talking with someone prior to this show about setting up an ecstatic dance in our church, and a monthly meeting to just enjoy that. Now you've been involved with the cosmic mass that involves movement. I think so important to get down into our bodies, isn't it, to be viscerally involved, because we are not just spiritual beings floating in some cloud, but we're actually embodied, and that incarnation is so important. Folks,
I encourage you to do that. The ecstatic dance movement here in Oakland, where I live, is very strong. In fact, one of the founders of it said he got the idea from our cosmic mass.
So there we go.
But the whole idea of getting people into their lower chakras, which is what we do when we dance, is so important, and that it happened in the churches, so that people get the connection between healthy religion and spirituality and our healthy bodies, and the connection to the earth. I mean, the earth would not be in the trouble it's in today if we were really connected to the earth, and that's for dance, and prayer as dance can really help us.
Yeah, the person I was talking with, Dale, she actually went to that center in Oakland and first danced the ecstatic dance there, so it's cool that it's connected to you. All right, we're at the break. I'm with Matthew Fox. We're talking about his very wonderful new book called Meister Eckhart, A Mystic Warrior for Our Times. Let's find out more in a couple of minutes after these messages from Unity.
If Unity Online Radio has helped you grow spiritually through programs like this one, please consider supporting this online radio programming. Visit www.unity.fm and click on Donate Now. Thank you for helping us continue to serve as the voice of an awakening world. At the base of all life is the infinite wellspring of Source, and each of us has a unique way of expressing that Source as an individualized soul. Do you enjoy the company of inspiring people who are living on purpose? Do you want to live joyfully attuned to your own unique soul expression? Host Reverend Kristen Powell welcomes you to join the gathering of souls who live this way. You'll meet artists, naturalists, and other soulful expressions that will inspire you to call forth the most alive, passionate version of yourself. Get into the natural stream of your own soul by tuning into Soul Stream live every Wednesday at noon Central Time on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Matthew Fox. We're talking about his new book. It's called Meister Eckhart, A Mystic Warrior for Our Times. And if you're familiar with Dr. Fox's work, you'll know that there's been a thread of Meister Eckhart through much of what he's done. The original translation of some of the sermons was called Breakthrough, later called Passion for Creation in a reprint, and many of us first read Meister Eckhart in that format, and so it's great that he's revisiting this wonderful mystic, this time connecting with modern day mystics and what they have to say about Meister Eckhart and how they sort of vibrate with his similar message. One of the things about Meister Eckhart, of course, as all mystics, is that they have a facility for embracing paradox. Yes, and you got to be okay with paradox, I think, if you're going to understand what mysticism is all about. If you're going to understand what God is all about, and there's a lovely quote here from Eckhart. He says, God created all things in such a way that they are not outside the God self, as ignorant people falsely imagine, as most of dualism and most of Christianity falsely imagines, unfortunately, that there's God on a cloud and then there's us. But God created all things in such a way that they are not outside the God self. That, like you said earlier, that could be straight out of the Upanishads or the Bhagavad Gita, couldn't it? That idea of that the same eye by which God sees us is the eye that we see God. So it's that we are one.
That's right. And it's panentheism, of course. Everything in God and God in everything.
Yes.
And that's the mystical way of seeing the world. And you're right. The Upanishads see it that way, and all the great mystics see it that way. And Eckhart is certainly explicit about that. And it's the opposite of theism, as you say. Theism has God up in the sky and us here. But panentheism has divinity within all things and us within divinity. And it's a very different way of seeing the world and seeing our spirituality and seeing God. obviously the churches have not done a good job of teaching this at all, and neither have the seminaries that create our ministers and priests. So there's a lot of work to do here in helping people to understand this much more mature understanding of our relationship to divine. Mechthilde Magdeburg, who lived in Eckhart's time, just a little bit older than he, but she was a great mystic too, a laywoman, a Beguine, a member of the women's movement of the Middle Ages, which Eckhart was a great supporter of, by the way. That got him in trouble. It's one reason he was condemned, but a week after he died. But Mechthilde Magdeburg said, "The day of my spiritual awakening was the day I saw and knew I saw all things in God and God in all things."
Mm-hmm.
So she attributes her breakthrough, her adult spirituality, to this realization that you've just spoken of the dependent theistic awareness rather than a theistic awareness, which is dualistic.
Right. And there's a difference, isn't there, that not everybody grasps, I think, between pantheism and panentheism. And the Bhagavad Gita talks about this. It says God is in everything, but not limited by anything. It's you know, in it, but not of it, if you like. So whereas pantheism is like, well, the whole sum of everything is God. And that's not, really not what we're saying. God has the ability to be mystically outside of everything, you know, transcendent and yet intimately involved, immanent at the same time. It's kind of another conundrum or paradox, but I think it's really important we understand this, because otherwise, in some sense, we're limiting what God is, aren't we, if we just have a pantheistic viewpoint.
Exactly. And panentheism is, what can I say, it's thoroughly orthodox if people understand it. And but it sounds strange to our ears almost, because again, as we've talked about, we're coming out of a cultural period, the modern era, where mysticism was not understood, and it was actually reduced to asceticism and kind of beating yourself in the basement or something. And so it sounds strange to us to speak this way, and yet it's found in the great mystics like Eckhart and Mechthild and others, but also it's found definitely in the scriptures. There's that one famous line in Acts that says, "God is the one in whom we live, move, and have our being." Well, that's panentheism. And so too are the mystical teachings in John's Gospel, where the Christ says, you know, "I am the vine and you are the branches, and I live in the Father and you live in us," and so forth. These are panentheistic sayings that are found right in the scriptures as well.
One thing the Zen tradition has is a famous line, and if you see the Buddha on the road, kill it. And Eckhart says, "I pray God to rid me of God." And you know, these seem like radical statements when you think, "My goodness, I'm supposed to lift up God and lift up the Buddha." But the concepts of God and the concept of Buddha could get in the way, can't it? And you have a whole chapter about self-emptying, letting go. And Eckhart says, again, all God wants of you is for you to let go of yourself and creatures and let God be within you. And if you don't, you're sort of easing God out, right, through that concept you have about God.
Well, that's right, and you're setting God up for a lot of projections. And I think that's one reason, by the way, that Carl Jung is attracted to Eckhart, too, is that Eckhart is really pulling the rug out from under our temptations to project onto God.
Mm.
And that very line you quote, "I pray God to rid me of God," that, you know, we can be wrapped in many versions of God that, in fact, are false or injurious. For example, that God is all male, or that God is white, or that God is American, or something like that. And so we have to rid ourselves of this in order to let God be God. And it's really the theological word for that projection is idolatry, where you
right.
freeze God into a form that that does not evolve, it does not change. And we're capable of that. It's not unlike believing in Santa Claus. You know, as children, we believe in Santa Claus, and we see Santa Claus this way. But you grow out of that as you grow older. But some people cling to their visions of God or their images of God throughout their life that they had when they were believing in Santa Claus. And
well, that's, right.
That's pure raw religion, and there's a good deal of it floating around, and it's usually used by politicians and others who are seeking power to manipulate.
Well, I think the fear is, though, when you jettison, you know, your old ideas of God, you're not sure if you're going to replace it with anything, and so it's scary. You know, what's going to be left if I release that idea? But, of course, what's left is reality, isn't it? What's left is a greater opportunity to see, you know, and experience the larger version of what this thing is. Of course, I've known for many years that God is actually British, so that's okay, though. But, you know, you're exactly right. You know, you grow up in a culture, and so you're imbued with the mores and the understandings of that culture. And, I remember being very disconsolate as a young person because the predominant view in Britain when I was growing up was a sort of a secularism and an empiricism, you know, that any belief in anything mystical was you know, a bit of a fool, you know, silly old fool for thinking those ways. And I guess if it gives you comfort or whatever, that's sort of a very patronizing attitude. But, you know, it was only when I discovered, I don't know if you've ever read the great book, his name was F.C. Happold, but he wrote a wonderful book on mysticism. It was published by Penguin Books, and I remember getting hold of that as a teenager, and it blew my mind because it was a collection of, you know, mysticism from the beginning of time until modern days, and it was just wonderful stuff. And I thought, my goodness, you know, there actually is this long tradition of people thinking and experiencing what I've always felt as a child and adolescent, but was scared to talk about it because it seemed to be peripheral, you know, to reality, to rationalism. But, you know, thank you for your work because you know, you've done so much to bring mysticism and its practicality and its visceral quality, you know, into the modern dialogue. And of course, I guess that seminal work, you know, Original Blessing, was such a great book because, you know, many of us grew up thinking, you know, that Christianity was based on original sin, and what a disservice that is. So this Original Blessing fits, of course, very much into the Unity way of looking at the wonders of creation.
Well, thank you, and now I understand, having heard a little bit more of your story, your appreciation of Wordsworth and Coleridge and so forth, that these English mystics of the earth-based mystics, nature mystics,
right,
really brought a lot to the table, and they were, in a way, the artists. As I say, in the modern era, it was the artists who were pushing back against the secularism and the scientism of the Industrial Revolution and the Enlightenment. And I think, and not just the poets, but also the musicians. I mean, think of Mahler and Mozart and all, and many poets were speaking this other language, a language that you were yearning to hear as a young man. And I grew up in the 50s in America, and I remember I preferred Saturday Mass as a Roman Catholic to Sunday, and now I know why, because Saturday was always dedicated to Mary, and of course Mary represents the Divine Feminine and the Goddess in the West, and the scriptures that the Church rolled out for Saturday Mass were these marvelous scriptures, for example, from the book of Sirach, that wisdom walks the vaults of the sky, she walks on the sands of the deep, or Proverbs, that wisdom plays with God before the creation of the world. And all these images were so cosmological to me, and they just really opened my heart up, and I was very moved by them. And so I give Catholicism credit for at least keeping the goddess in the picture, if you will, for a little bit. Because that's part of the mystical journey, too, that wisdom is feminine. She's feminine in the Bible. She's feminine around the world. And we went on this great pursuit of knowledge in the modern era, but wisdom has pretty much fallen by the wayside. So I think it's part of the patriarchal excess of the modern era that we're missing out on the divine feminine. And again, this is a contribution from Eckhart. He had a marvelous balance of the two, and And he says, what does God do all day long? God lies on a maternity bed giving birth. So he had no trouble at all with the tradition of the motherhood of God. Again, something you find in Hinduism. And right after Eckhart, you have Julian of Norwich, who's, of course, one of the first writers of in the English language, the first woman writer, and she's explicit about the motherhood of God. So that whole tradition needs attention, too, because when you look around the world today and see what's going on, there's an awful lot of excess testosterone, if you will. There's excess reptilian brain energy put into war and resolving our differences with war instead of with understanding and peace and respect and so forth and nonviolence. All this, I think, speaks of the feminine dimension of our journey and of God. And part of praying God to rid us of God is to let go of that all patriarchal God that blesses tanks and warplanes and nuclear submarines, but doesn't really teach us how to tame our reptilian brain and to celebrate our powers of compassion.
Right. And, of course, we got to remember, too, that the feminine also enfolds in it, you know, a destructive aspect, but in the sense of transformation and cleansing. You know, you think of Mother Kali, or you think of the wrathful parts of feminism, that there's that amazing power that can take those stupidities, if you like, those dualities, and destroy them and bring forth something new. I shared on Sunday that I went to the Oratory of St. Joseph in Montreal. I visited it 20 years ago, went back because it was such an impressive building. And it was founded, I think, by Brother Andre. And it's got many levels. You know, there's the sanctuary, and then there's a healing chamber, and there's the votive corridor. But anyway, tucked behind the church, it's built on a hill. It's a solid rock that it's built on. Tucked behind, right next to the elevator, with water dripping down the rocks, there's an image of Mother Mary lit in blue and gold. And I saw it last summer, and I just burst into tears. And I think it was the fact that it was sort of hidden behind everything in the grotto, and right next to the elevator, almost forgotten. But this beatific image, I'm not a Catholic, but it hit me as the Divine Mother. And like I say, I was just overwhelmed, you know, because it was the beauty and compassion, but the strength and power, too, of that femininity that's within everything, within the rocks, within our hearts, you know, often hidden, often denied, but there still as the great creative force of the universe. It gives me chills now just talking about it. It's a powerful image, isn't it? It's a powerful archetype.
Absolutely, it is. And it's been missing, you see. Like Jung says, archetypes return when we need them. And like the Black Madonna archetype, which incorporates some of that fierceness that you spoke to, but also it incorporates the sense of the grief of our time, the grief for Mother Earth, and of course, the people of color and what they've often undergone because of their color, of their skin and so forth, and the fact that we all come from Africa, so in fact we're all daughters of the Black Madonna and sons. So all this is coming alive again in our time, and I think your tears are a powerful example of that, that just seeing the Divine Mother named again carries more weight today, because Gaia is Mother Earth, and Mother Earth is undergoing a lot of pain and struggle right now. We've got to wake up and do what we can do.
When I went to Wales a couple of years ago after my daughter got married, she came with us and with a new husband, and we had a special puja in the ashram we used to attend in Wales, and it was at the Mahashakti Temple, which is, again, another form of the Divine Mother. And because we were the guests of honor, we were up front, so we were very close to the image, you know, which is tremendously powerful. It was a wonderful blessing. I felt that amazing force of the divine feminine, you know, in that, moving in and through that that puja. And it was a wonderful thing to have my daughter there, you know, be blessed by these monks that I'd known since I was in my 20s. And And they gave us a coconut at the end, you know, because they break a coconut to, you know, as an offering and light it. And it's still on my altar at my house. So it's a, these things can be very meaningful, can't they? Because they are visceral. You know, you feel the energy moving in your body.
Absolutely. And the energy from the body of Mother Earth. And like you have these, I have a former student who's Irish, and she leads people on pilgrimages to the sacred wells of Ireland.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
On the Celts, including Wales, of the
yes.
strength, womanhood. And that's something that, you know, the world needs to hear and honor once and respect once again. And, you know, men have to get off our perch and do more introspection, really, to discover what our nobility is, what our
yes.
strength. And it's not just about making war. You know, we're now spending as a species $58,000 a second on war. Now, how stupid is that? You know, what's
yeah, really?
Do with our money? That makes a little more sense, and that would respect Mother Earth and pass it on as both beautiful and healthy to our children and grandchildren whom we claim to love. All that
yeah.
involves the recovery of the Divine Feminine.
Yes. Folks, I'm with Matthew Fox. We're talking about his new book, amongst other things, Meister Eckhart, the Mystic Warrior for Our Times. We're at the break again. Let's listen to these messages from Unity, and we'll come back and talk some more about this great book.
If you've ever wondered how a specific Bible verse might be interpreted metaphysically, then Interpret This is for you. In Interpret This, Unity Minister Reverend Ed Townley answers your questions about the Bible and how to apply its verses to your life with passion, depth, and spiritual insight. To submit a question or to enjoy any of his numerous metaphysical interpretations, visit unity.org and click on the Interpret This box.
Spirit of Recovery is the place where spirituality and recovery meet, where we support your spiritual growth. Reverend Anna Schaus, Ph.D., interviews down-to-earth guests who share with you how they keep going and growing in recovery. Spirit of Recovery is the place to get practical tips and join in lively discussions on topics that matter to recovering people. This program welcomes everyone who wants to know more about recovery. Join Anna and her guests live every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Central Time on Spirit of Recovery, where we talk about what keeps you growing. Only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Now back to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to the third segment. I'm with Matthew Fox. I was going to say I'm with Meister Eckhart. That would be cool. But it's just as cool to be with Matthew Fox. But you think you are with Meister Eckhart. I tell you what, because this book is so in tune with his thinking and introduces us to so many other great mystics who and world changers, thought leaders of our modern era. So it's just a joy. It's a joy to dip into it. And at any point, I would suggest, you know, you get it's a primer for wonderful things. And there's a chapter, of course, on the historical Jesus, and you meet in that chapter Marcus Borg, who, bless his heart, just passed from us, didn't he, recently?
Yeah.
What a wonderful man he is, along with John Dominic Crossan, great figures in terms of looking for the historical Jesus, breaking through the mythologizing, perhaps, that's led us astray back into the heart of who Jesus really was. And of course, Eckhart loved Jesus, you know, in that sense, not in as a savior outside of us, but as that cosmic presence within us. Yeah,
definitely. And he saw the distinction between Jesus and Christ.
Yes.
That contemporary scholarship has kind of rediscovered, if you will, but that a lot of religion has tended to muddle. And you know, it's important to realize that the difference between historical Jesus, the man who lived to be about 30 years old and got killed by the empire, and the Christ, which was is a bigger concept, if you will, that he himself certainly incarnated, represented, and spoke about. But in fact, it applies to all of us, that we are all sons and daughters of God, and that we all have a role to play in carrying on the spiritual energy of our ancestors. So Eckhart is very strong in that, and this too is a big part of the current scholarship on Jesus.
You know, there's such kickback, pushback on this, isn't there, in more traditional evangelical areas of belief and endeavor in our country. And I'm thinking about Rob Bell, if you're familiar with him, but he's an evangelical preacher, built a large church, and then started writing books that were sort of almost unitive. That one was called Love Wins, and the idea that love is paramount, and the fact that, you know, there is no hell, and that Jesus is a presence within each one of us in a very real sense. And unfortunately, he was, really torn apart by those that are holding on to these old dualistic ways of thinking. It's kind of sad.
Mm.
But yeah, I guess that's part of what happens, right? I mean, it happened to you, didn't it?
Well, that's right. You know, there's no hatred like fratricide.
Yeah.
So heretics get pretty badly treated in human history. And so people who are trying to kind of stretch and expand spiritual experience and the experience of the Christ and of Jesus, sometimes they'll take a few hard knocks, just like Jesus did. After all, he was trying to expand the Jewish tradition of his time, and he took some hard knocks, some of them from fellow Jews and some of them from the empire, so he got hit from two angles at least. So that definitely happened, yeah. And among other things, of course, it tests the integrity of your journey and of what you really believe and don't believe. And I think that this critical time in human and planetary history, I think a lot of people have to stand up and be counted and to put love ahead of fear. King was once asked, how can you march in Skokie, Illinois, knowing people want to shoot you? And he said, well, you have to love something more than the fear of death if you're going to live.
Yeah.
So I think courage is really required in our time. And courage comes from, it means a big heart in French, cœur large. And we grow our hearts with joy and with love. And there's one reason for reading the mystics. Someone like Eckhart, I mean, he too took it on the chin. You know, he was under attack toward the end of his life, and they condemned him a week after he died, actually. And that's one reason why he's not well known within church circles, because he was condemned. And but he was doing us all a great favor, as was Jesus, of course, as was Dr. King and many others. Been badly treated often within their own communities, such as Gandhi.
This is true. Now, in terms of what you want people to take away from this book, you know, what is it particularly that you think is of crucial importance at this particular time in our history?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that one of the signs of our times is interfaith and what I call deep ecumenism, that we've got to draw the wisdom from the world religions and get world religions to stand together in terms of defending Mother Earth and children and women and future generations. And so we need both this mystical energy of love and the prophetic energy, the warrior energy, of standing up for what we cherish. So I hope that people would get from this book that it's possible, Eckhart showed it's possible, that we can find what is wise in our various traditions, and instead of going to war with each other or proselytizing and trying to convert each other, that we work together to make our species sustainable again and the planet itself as we know it, with all its beauty and diversity. currently our species is not sustainable. And the question is, can we turn it around? And people like Eckhart challenge us and also show us ways. And, of course, it begins with ourselves. It really does begin with our ceasing to project and our finding ways to be at peace and to honor what is respectful in all of us. And then that's what we should be projecting, is the love we have found inside. That's what Jesus said, didn't he? We love others the way we love ourselves.
Right.
So we have to start learning to love all our being, our lower chakras, as well as our upper chakras, and we have to respect this in one another. I think Eckhart is a champion of that.
Yeah, and it involves economics too, doesn't it? And that's one of your four E's at the end of the book. And I was listening to a show about the European company Unilever. It's a large, huge multinational, but they are really into, you know, zero waste and repackaging everything and reusing products. So there's nothing goes to the landfill, and it really been on the cutting edge. I think the company was founded by someone who was very much into ecology, but it shows that even, you know, huge conglomerates and multinationals can be ecological and can lead the way. So this to me is very encouraging. It doesn't have to come from that sort of fringe. It could come from within the center as well. I think this is a shift, you know, to see what we've always done, but in a new way, in a creative way. And I find that greatly inspiring.
Indeed, and hopeful. I think a lot of people are waking up, both within organizations and on the fringes. And this is our hope. I do talk about the four E's, being a new economics, one that will work for everyone and all the beings on the planet, a new education. I think we need education that really puts forward the common values that we all share and yearn to share. And then ecology, of course, is really the setting in which we all finding ourselves. We have to make ethical decisions now. And then finally, ecumenism, as I spoke about earlier. This is about gathering all the wisdom of the world's spiritual traditions instead of competing to stand together and make this a survivable circumstance and render our species sustainable.
We have 1 minute left. What do you think of the Je Suis Charlie movement in France and in other countries right now in response to the terrorist attacks on that newspaper?
Well, obviously, Europe in particular is very under attack, if you will, and this creates a sense of community and even a sense of the other. You see, so I am someone else. That's a good thing that we move beyond our egos and our particular private agendas.
Right.
So I think that's some of the good that can come out of these tragedies. Same time, I wouldn't mark Charlie some kind of saint. I think he went too far. I think in dishonoring the Muslim tradition. Now I know in the West you're allowed to do that thing, and you have to keep a sense of humor. But I do think that we want to try to respect people different from ourselves. And I wouldn't give Charlie really good grades on that.
Right. That's so you agree with the Pope then? Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. The idea that we're open to satire and be able to laugh at everybody, including ourselves—that's a very healthy and necessary thing.
Right. Yeah. Good point. Let me tell you about next week, and then we'll say goodbye to Matthew Fox. Next week, Gina Vucci comes to talk with me about the relationship handbook that she wrote with Shakti Gawain. It's the latest book that they've created, and it's a path to consciousness, healing, and growth. So that should be an interesting show. But right now, I want to really thank Matthew Fox for being on the show. And get this book, folks. It really is fascinating. If you're at all interested in anything mystical and how to make mystical practical in everyday life, this is the book, and it's warm, it's wonderful, it's well-argued, and it's just a delight to read. But thank you so much, Dr. Fox, for being with us today.
Thank you, Paul John, for having me and for having a program that allows us to talk about the important things.
And actually, Matthew joins me again in a month or so, this time with Rupert Sheldrake, talking about a book they've republished. It's called The Physics of Angels. So I'm interested to know more about that. So that's going to be a fascinating show. And thanks, folks, for listening to this show and keeping this on the air. It's a voice of an awakening world. We're grateful for your presence with us. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on Unity FM, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
Ever notice how the funniest things happen when we stop taking ourselves too seriously and step out boldly? Listen to Funniest Thing with Daryl and Ed as these unlikely saints administer a refreshing dose of laughter and love that will inspire you to step out boldly and experience the funniest things. Join the discussion with Daryl and Ed live every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Central Time on Funniest Thing, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Things may happen around you, things may happen to you, but the only things that really count are the things that happen in you.
This meditative moment from Reverend Eric Butterworth is brought to you by Unity.
Truly understand the laws of the universe and live a life based on these profound and unwavering truths, then your dream life starts today. No more waiting, no more wandering. If you're ready to let go of the striving and move into the allowing, you're ready for Everyday Attraction on Unity Online Radio. We study the teaching of Abraham given to us by beautiful Esther Hicks, so we can release confusion for clarity, exchange struggle for serenity, and have the time of our lives today. Join host Ray Zander every Friday at noon Central Time, 10 a.m. Pacific, on Unity Online Radio for Everyday Attraction, where the law of attraction gets real.
Somewhere, tucked away in the Unity Library archives in Unity Village, Missouri, you can find a secret treasure. They are the scripts from Unity co-founder Charles Fillmore's early days on broadcast radio, the teachings of Unity's founders, almost 100 years old. Now, for the first time in history, you can hear them through the power of the Internet. Join Bob Brock every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, for Unity Classic Radio, Words from Our Past. Discover the wisdom of Charles Fillmore's talks and of other Unity Radio speakers read on the air again. Call in your comments and questions as Bob and his special guests revisit Unity Radio talks of the past, along with historical background from the early days of the Unity movement. That's Unity Classic Radio, Words from Our Past, every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, right here on Unity FM, the voice of an awakening world.
sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.